seen that hardened veteran politician, Speaker of the House, James G. Blaine, cry. But there he sat, with the tears streaming unashamedly down his cheeks, unable to conceal his emotions from the full view of the House members and spectators. But few on the floor or in the galleries on that dramatic day in 1874 were paying much attention to Mr. Blaine, and most were making no attempt to hide their own tears. Democrats and Republicans alike, battle-scarred veterans of the Civil War and the violence of politics, sat in somber silence as they listened to the urgent entreaties of the freshman congressman from Mississippi. Speaking simply, clearly, without resorting to the customary rhetorical devices, his full, rich voice touched the hearts of every listener with its simple plea for amity and justice between North and South. All were touched, yes, by his message, but stunned, too, by its impact. For Lucius Lamar of Mississippi was appealing in the name of the South's most implacable enemy, the radical Republicans who had helped make the Reconstruction period a black nightmare the South could never forget, Charles Sumner of Massachusetts. Charles Sumner, who assailed Daniel Webster as a traitor for seeking to keep the South in the Union, whose death was hastened by the terrible caning administered to him on the Senate floor years earlier by Congressman Brooks of South Carolina, who thereupon became a Southern hero. Charles Sumner was now dead. And Lucius Lamar of the Deep South was standing on the floor of the House and delivering a moving eulogy lamenting his departure. There was an ominous silence. A silence of both meditation and shock. Then a spontaneous burst of applause rolled out from all sides. Few speeches in American political history have had such an immediate impact. Overnight, it raised Lamar to the first rank in the Congress and in the country, and more importantly, it marked a turning point in the relations between North and South. 2 weeks after the Sumner eulogy, Carl Schurz of Missouri rose before 10,000 citizens of Boston and hailed Lamar as the prophet of a new day in the relations between North and South. It was inevitable that some, both North and South, would misunderstand it. Northerners, whose political power depended on maintaining the federal hegemony over the former Confederate states, resisted any effort to heal sectional strife. Southerners, to whom Charles Sumner symbolized the worst of the pre-war abolitionist movement and the post-war Reconstruction, felt betrayed. It was generally recognized, however, North and South, that the speech, which could have been a disaster, was in fact a notable triumph. It was obvious that, moved by the strange forces of history and personal destiny, the man and the occasion had met that day in Washington. Who was the man? Lucius Quintus Cincinnatus Lamar was, in 1874, a public man. No petty issues, no political trivia, not even private affairs were permitted to clutter up his intellect. No partisan, personal, or sectional considerations could outweigh his devotion to the national interest and to the truth. He was not only a statesman, but also a scholar and one of the few original thinkers of his day. A black thread of moodiness and depression ran throughout all of Lamar's life. Although it never conquered him, his contemporaries observed his self-absorption, his sensitive and, on occasions, morose nature. His youth was, on the whole, however, a happy one, on a plantation in the area where Joel Harris was to collect his Uncle Remus and Brer Rabbit tales. Lamar himself was famous later for his stories of the rural South. Lamar, from the beginning, under his mother's direction, showed a notable aptitude for study. Lamar became well-read in diplomacy and the law, but he was also passionately fond of light literature. Emory College, which Lamar attended, was a hotbed of states' rights. Its president, a member of the celebrated Longstreet family, was a flaming follower of Calhoun, and his influence over Lamar, always strong, increased when Lamar married his daughter. When Longstreet left Georgia to take over the presidency of the State University at Oxford, Mississippi, Lamar accompanied him to practice law and to teach. And it was while at the university that Lamar was presented with the opportunity which commenced his public career. On March 5, 1850, the legislature of the state of Mississippi adopted a series of resolutions instructing the representatives of Mississippi to vote against the admission of California. When Senator Foote disregarded these instructions in a noticeable display of courage, Lamar was prevailed upon by a committee of states' rights Democrats to debate the senator upon the latter's return to Mississippi to run for governor. Lamar was only 26 years of age, new to the state and the political life of his day, and was given only a few hours to prepare for debate against one of the most skilled and aggressive politicians of the times. But his extemporaneous speech was a notable success, and at the end of the debate, the students of the university bore him away upon their shoulders. His election to Congress as a strong supporter of the doctrines of Calhoun and Jefferson Davis followed. In Congress, Lamar was violently pro-Southern. "Others may boast," he said on the floor of the House, "of their widely extended patriotism and their enlarged and comprehensive love of this Union. With me, I confess that the promotion of Southern interests is second in importance only to the preservation of Southern honor." By 1860, having lost all hope that the South could obtain justice in the Federal Union, he walked out of the Democratic Convention in Charleston with Jefferson Davis, helping to break still another link in the chain of Union. His pre-war career reached its climax in 1861, when he drafted the Ordinance of Secession dissolving Mississippi's ties with the Union. The wind had been sown. Now Lamar and Mississippi were to reap the whirlwind. On both it fell with equal violence. Certainly many of the trials and much of the agony which dogged the South in the years after the war were due to the loss and the struggle of those who might have been expected to assert the leadership of the region. Of the 13 descendants of the first Lamar in America who served in the Confederate armies with the rank of lieutenant colonel or above, 7 perished in the war. Lamar's own military career was ended by an attack of apoplexy, a disease from which he suffered throughout his entire life and which hung over him like death in moments of high excitement. He served nearly all of the remainder of the war as a diplomatic agent for the Confederate government. With the end of the war, which had blasted all of Lamar's hopes and illusions, he was under strong pressure to leave the wreck of the past and go to another country. He felt that he was a leader who had carried his people into the wilderness from which there had been no return, but he followed Robert Lee's advice to the leaders of the South to remain and share the fate of their respective states. And from 1865 to 1872, Lamar lived quietly in Mississippi, teaching and practicing law as his state passed through the bitter days of its reconstruction. Lamar came to understand that the sole hope for the South lay not in pursuing its ancient quarrels with the North, but in promoting conciliation and in the development and restitution of normal federal-state relations and the withdrawal of military rule. He came to believe that the future happiness of the country could only lie in a spirit of mutual conciliation and cooperation between the people of all sections and all states. There were two forces in opposition to his policy. On the one hand were those Republican leaders who believed that only by waving the bloody shirt could they maintain their support in the North and East. On the other hand, there were those in the South who traveled the easy road to influence and popularity through pandering to and exploiting the natural resentment and bitterness of the defeated South against its occupiers. In contrast, Lamar believed that the only course I, in common with other Southern representatives, have to follow is to do what we can to allay excitement between the sections and to bring about peace and reconciliation. In 1872, he was elected to Congress. Sumner's death and the invitation of Representative Hoar of Massachusetts to pronounce the eulogy furnished the ideal occasion for which Lamar had long awaited to hold out the hand of friendship to the North. This was Lucius Lamar's first opportunity to demonstrate a new kind of Southern statesmanship, but it would not be his last. Riding a wave of popularity and the 1876 return to Democratic rule in Mississippi, Lamar was elected by the legislature to the United States Senate. But even before he moved from the House to the Senate, Lamar again outraged many of his backers by abandoning his party and section on another heated issue. The Hayes-Tilden presidential contest of 1876 had been a bitter struggle, apparently culminating in a close electoral vote victory for the Democrat, Tilden. Although Hayes at first accepted his defeat with philosophic resignation, his lieutenants, with the cooperation of the Republican New York Times, converted the apparent certainty of Tilden's election into doubt by claiming the closely contested states of South Carolina, Louisiana, and Florida, and then attempted to convert that doubt into the certainty of Hayes' election by procuring from the carpetbag governments of those three states doctored election returns. With rumors of violence and military dictatorship rife, Congress determined upon arbitration by a supposedly nonpartisan electoral commission. But when the commission, acting wholly along party lines, awarded the disputed states and the election to Hayes with 185 electoral votes to 184 for Tilden, the South was outraged. 4 more years of Republican rule meant 4 more years of Southern bondage and exploitation. 4 more years before the South could regain her dignity and her rightful place in the nation. Lamar was accused of trading his vote and his section's honor for a promise of a future position. He was accused of cowardice, of being afraid to stand up for his state when it meant a fight, and he was accused of deserting his people and his party in the very hour when triumph should have been at last rightfully theirs. But Lucius Lamar, a man of law and honor, could not now repudiate the findings, however shocking, of the commission he had helped establish. It was better, he believed, for the South, in spite of provocation, to accept defeat on this occasion. He was skillful enough, however, to get Hayes committed to concessions for the South, including the withdrawal of military occupation forces and a return to home rule in key states. No other high-ranking Confederate officer had yet entered the Senate, nor had many senators forgotten that nearly 20 years earlier, Lamar was an extreme sectionalist congressman who had resigned his seat to draft the Mississippi Ordinance of Secession. The time was not auspicious for his return. As Senator Lamar, ill and fatigued, rested at his home throughout much of 1877, a new movement was sweeping the South and West, a movement which would plague the political parties of the nation for a generation to come. Free Silver. Silver Dick Bland, the Democratic representative from Missouri, was leading the way with his bill for the free coinage of all silver brought to the mint. Inasmuch as a tremendous spurt in the production of the Western silver mines had caused its value in relation to gold to shrink considerably, the single purpose of the silver forces was clear, simple, and appealing. Easy, inflationary money. It was a tremendously popular cause in Mississippi. The panic of 1873 had engulfed the nation into the most terrible depression it had ever suffered, and the already impoverished states of the South were particularly hard hit. Businesses failed by the thousands, unemployment increased, and wages were reduced. Farm prices dropped rapidly from their high wartime levels, and the farmers of Mississippi, desperate for cash, vowed support for any bill which would raise the price of their commodities, lower the value of the debts, and increase the availability of money. The South foresaw itself in a state of permanent indebtedness to the financial institutions of the East, unless easy money could be made available to pay its heavy debts. Silver suddenly acquired a political appeal as the poor man's friend, in contrast to gold, the rich man's money. Silver was the money of the prairies and small towns, unlike gold, the money of Wall Street. Silver was going to provide an easy solution to everyone's problems, falling farm prices, high interest rates, heavy debts, and all the rest. Although the Democratic Party, since the days of Jackson and Benton, had been the party of hard money, it rushed to exploit this new and popular issue, and it was naturally assumed that the freshman Democratic senator from poverty-stricken Mississippi would enthusiastically join the fight. But Lamar, the learned scholar and professor, approached the issue somewhat differently than his colleagues. Paying but little heed to the demands of his constituents, he exhausted all available treatises on both sides of the controversy. His study convinced him, possibly wrongly, that the only sound position was in support of sound money. The payment of our government's debts in a debased, inflated currency, as the Bland Bill encouraged and the accompanying Matthews resolution specifically provided, was an ethical wrong and a practical mistake. On January 24, 1878, in a courageous and learned address, his first major speech on the Senate floor, Lamar rejected the pleas of Mississippi voters and assailed elaborate rationalizations behind the two silver measures as artificial and exaggerated. And the following day, he voted no on the Matthews resolution in opposition to his colleague from Mississippi, a Negro Republican of exceptional talents, elected several years earlier by the old carpetbag legislature. Praise for Senator Lamar's masterly and statesmanlike analysis of the issue emanated from many parts of the country, but from Mississippi came little but condemnation. On January 30th, the state legislature adopted a memorial omitting all mention of Lamar, but, in an obvious and deliberate slap, congratulating and thanking his colleague, to whom the white Democratic legislatures normally were bitterly opposed, for voting the opposite way and thus reflecting the sentiment and will of his constituents. The memorial deeply hurt Lamar. But the legislature was not through. On February 4th, a resolution was passed by both houses instructing Lamar to vote for the Bland Silver Bill and to use his efforts as spokesman for Mississippi to secure its passage. Lamar was deeply troubled by this action. He confided, "I cannot do it. I had rather quit politics forever." He attempted to explain at length to a friend in the legislature that he recognized that the right of that body to express its opinions upon questions of federal policy and the obligation of a senator to abide by those expressions whenever he was doubtful as to what his course should be. But in this particular case, he insisted, "Their wishes are directly in conflict with the convictions of my whole life, and had I voted on the Matthews resolution as directed, I should have cast my first vote against my conscience." Having decided that the bill was wrong, he was anxious to demonstrate to the nation that statesmanship was not dead in the South, nor was the South desirous of repudiating national obligations and honor. 1 week later, the Bland Silver Bill came before the Senate for a final vote. As the debate neared its end, Senator Lamar rose unexpectedly to his feet. No notes were in his hand, for he was one of the most brilliant extemporaneous speakers ever to sit in the Senate. "Mr. President, between these resolutions and my convictions there is a great gulf. I cannot pass it. My reasons for my vote shall be given to my people. Then it will be for them to determine if adherence to my honest convictions has disqualified me from representing them. I know that the time is not far distant when they will recognize my action today as wise and just. I shall calmly await the results." Senators on both sides of the bill immediately crowded about his desk to commend his courage. Lamar knew that his speech and vote could not prevent passage of the Bland Bill by a tremendous margin, and its subsequent enactment over the veto of President Hayes. Yet his intentional and stunningly courageous disobedience to the will of his constituents was not wholly in vain. Throughout the North, the speech was highly praised. Distrust toward the South and suspicions of its attitude toward the national debt and national credit diminished. But the assault upon the senator in Mississippi was instantaneous and vigorous. He had turned his back on his people in his section. His old friend Jefferson Davis hurt him deeply by publicly condemning Lamar's disregard of the legislature's instruction as an attack upon the foundation of our political system. All agreed that Lamar was politically dead after one term, and the only question was who would succeed him. Lamar loved Mississippi, and its criticism depressed him deeply. Admittedly, he had violated the instructions of the legislature, he said. "I will appeal to the sovereign people, the masters of the legislature, who undertake to instruct me." With his declaration, Senator Lamar launched successive tours of Mississippi. Speaking to thousands of people in crowded halls and open fields, Lamar stated frankly that he was well aware that he had not pleased his constituents, that he was equally well aware that the easier path was to exploit that sectional cause to which he had always been devoted. But that it was his intention to help create a feeling of confidence and mutuality between North and South by voting in the national interest without regard to sectional pressures. For 3 or 4 hours at a time, his passionate and imaginative oratory held spellbound the crowds that came to jeer. The tour was tremendously successful. Men who were so hostile that they could hardly be persuaded to hear him at all would mount upon the benches and tables, swinging their hats and huzzaing until hoarse. Others departed in silence, weighing the significance of his words. It is heartening to note that the people of Mississippi continued their support of him, in spite of the fact that on 3 important occasions, in his eulogy of Charles Sumner, in his support of the Electoral Commission, which brought about the election of Republican Hayes, and in his exception to their strongly felt stand for free silver, Lamar had stood against their immediate wishes. The voters responded to the sincerity and courage which he had shown, and they continued to give him their support and affection throughout the remainder of his political life. He was reelected to the Senate by an overwhelming majority, later to become Secretary of the Interior, and finally Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. At no time did he ever veer from the deep conviction he had expressed while under bitter attack in 1878. The liberty of this country and its great interests will never be secure if its public men become mere menials to do the biddings of their constituents instead of being representatives in the true sense of the word, looking to the lasting prosperity and future interests of the whole country. The time and the place. 2 men of integrity, both Republicans, both Midwesterners, but wholly dissimilar in their political philosophies and personal mannerisms, best illustrate the impact of the 20th century upon the Senate as a whole, and the atmosphere of political courage in particular. George W. Norris and Robert A. Taft, whose careers in the Senate overlapped for only a brief period, were masters of the legislative process, leaders of fundamentally opposed political factions, and expounders, each in his own way, of great constitutional doctrines. And not among the least of their accomplishments was the increased prestige and respect which they and others like them brought to the United States Senate. For, at the turn of the century, the route to fame and power for men of ability and talent had been an industry, not politics, and as a result, the attitude of the public toward the political profession had too often been characterized by apathy, indifference, disrespect, and even amusement. The Senate had shared in the political profession's loss of prestige. It was due, in part, to the public reaction to the new type of legislator, who, too often in 1900, included the swollen corporation lawyer and the squalid political boss. The Senate seemed to have little of the excitement and drama that had been so much a part of its existence in the years leading up to the Civil War, little of the power and prestige which it wielded so brazenly in the days of the Johnson and Grant administrations. No longer were the names of famous senators familiar household words. No longer did the entire nation breathlessly follow Senate debates, as in the days of the Great Compromise or the Johnson impeachment. The nation's brightest schoolboys, who 60 or 70 years earlier would have memorized Webster's reply to Hayne, were no longer interested in politics as a career. Those citizens who did take an active interest in the conduct of the Senate as the 20th century got underway generally viewed it more with alarm than with pride. Throughout the nation there arose a remarkable array of reformers, muckrakers, and good government movements, represented in the Senate by a new breed of idealists and independents, men of ability and statesmanship who would have ranked with the more famous names of an earlier day. To arrest the dual trends of an electorate indifferent to their senators and senators indifferent to their electorate, the reformers, both in and out of the Senate, finally accomplished a long overdue change in the election machinery. The power of electing senators was taken from the legislatures of the states and given directly to the people. The 17th Amendment, ratified in 1913, reflected a far different attitude towards the masses of voters than the distrust with which they were regarded in 1787 by the creators of the Constitution, but it also reflected a general decline in the respect for state legislatures, which had too often permitted powerful lobbyists and political machines to usurp their sacred right of selecting senators. That the 17th Amendment almost immediately made the Senate more responsive to popular will, both in theory and in fact, cannot be doubted. But its effects were not as far-reaching, nor was the complexion and makeup of the Senate changed as greatly as the reformers had hoped. Even more important was the Senate's gradually increasing power in the field of foreign affairs, a power which multiplied as our nation's stature in the community of nations grew, a power which made the Senate in the 20th century a far more significant body in terms of the actual consequences of its decisions than the glittering Senate of Webster, Clay, and Calhoun, which had toiled endlessly but fruitlessly over the slavery question. And just as a nation torn by internal crisis had demanded senators of courage in 1850, so did a nation plunged into international crisis. John Quincy Adams had realized this 100 years before George Norris ever came to Washington. But he could not have foreseen that this nation's role in the world would bring constantly recurring crises and troublesome problems to the floor of the United States Senate, crises which would force men like George Norris to choose between conscience and constituents, problems which would force men like Bob Taft to choose between principles and popularity. These are not the only stories of political courage in the 20th century, possibly not even the most outstanding or significant. Yet, the changing nature of the Senate, its work and its members, seems to have lessened the frequency with which the nation is given inspiration by a selfless stand for great but unpopular principles. Perhaps we are still too close in time to those in our own midst, whose actions a more detached historical perspective may someday stamp as worthy of recording in the annals of political courage. Perhaps the 20th century senator is not called upon to risk his entire future on one basic issue, in the manner of a Edmund Ross or Thomas Hart Benton. Perhaps our modern acts of political courage do not arouse the public in the manner that crushed the career of Sam Houston and John Quincy Adams. Still, when we realize that a newspaper that chooses to denounce a senator today can reach many thousand times as many voters as could be reached by all of Daniel Webster's famous and articulate detractors put together, these stories of 20th century political courage have a drama, an excitement, and an inspiration all their own. George Norris. At precisely 1 p.m. one wintry afternoon early in 1910, Representative John Dalzell of Pennsylvania left the Speaker's chair and walked out of the House chamber for his daily cup of coffee and a piece of pie in the Capitol restaurant. His departure was not unusual, for Representative Dalzell, who was Speaker Joe Cannon's first assistant in ruling the House from the Speaker's chair, had always left the chamber at exactly that hour, and he was almost invariably succeeded in the chair by Representative Walter Smith of Iowa. But on that particular afternoon, the assistant speaker had no sooner reached the door of the chamber when Republican Representative George W. Norris of Nebraska walked over to Representative Smith and asked if he might be recognized for 2 minutes. To his astonishment, Representative Norris sought to amend the resolution then under debate, a resolution calling for a joint committee to investigate the Ballinger-Pinchot conservation dispute, by requiring the entire House of Representatives to appoint its members to the investigating committee, instead of granting the customary authority to the Speaker to make such selections. Page boys scurried out to find Cannon and Dalzell. This was insurrection in the ranks, the first attempt to limit the previously unlimited power of Czar Cannon. But Norris insisted that all he desired was a fair investigation, not one rigged by the administration. He succeeded in having his amendment adopted by the narrow margin of 149 to 146. It was the first setback the powerful speaker had ever suffered, and he vowed never to forget it. But for George Norris, the victory on the investigation resolution was only a preliminary step, for in the inner pocket of his threadbare black coat was a scrawled resolution which he had drafted years before, a resolution to have the House, rather than the Speaker, appoint the members of the Rules Committee itself. the committee which completely dictated the House program and was in turn completely dominated by the Speaker. On St. Patrick's Day in 1910, Norris rose to address the Tsar. Only minutes before, Cannon had ruled that a census bill promoted by one of his cohorts was privileged under the Constitution and could be considered out of order, inasmuch as that document provided for the taking of the census. "Mr. Speaker," called Norris, "I present a resolution made privileged by the Constitution." "The gentleman will present it," replied Cannon, smugly aware of the attack that was about to be launched. And George Norris unfolded that tattered paper from his coat pocket and asked the clerk to read it aloud. Panic broke out in the Republican leadership. Cannon's own ruling on the census bill in support of his friend had given Norris and his resolution, clearly based on the Constitution's provision for House rules, an opening through which the Nebraska congressman led all of his insurgent and Democratic forces. Cannon and his lieutenants were masters of parliamentary maneuvering, and they were not immediately ready to concede. They attempted to adjourn to recess to make a quorum impossible. They continued debate on whether the resolution was privileged, while the party faithful hurried back from St. Patrick's Day parades. They kept the House in constant session, hoping to break the less organized revolters. All night long, the insurgents stayed in their seats, unwilling to nap off the floor for fear that Cannon would suddenly rule in their absence. Finally, all attempts at intimidation and compromise having failed, Speaker Cannon, as expected, ruled the resolution out of order, and Norris promptly appealed the decision. By a vote of 182 to 160, Democrats and insurgent Republicans overruled the Speaker, and by a still larger margin, Norris's resolution, already amended to obtain Democratic support, was adopted. The most ruthless and autocratic Speaker in the history of the House of Representatives thereupon submitted his resignation, but George Norris, who insisted his fight was to end the dictatorial power of the office rather than to punish the individual, voted against its acceptance. The overthrow of Cannonism broke the stranglehold which the conservative Republican leaders had held over the government and the nation, and it also ended whatever favors the representative from Nebraska had previously received at their hands. Under the Tsar, the office of the Speaker of the House wielded what sometimes appeared to be very nearly equal power with the President and the entire United States Senate. It was a power that placed party above all other considerations, a power that fed on party loyalty, patronage, and political organizations. It was a power which, despite increasing disfavor in all parts of the country, outside the East, had continued unchallenged for years, but one man without a position, an editor commented, against 200 welded into the most powerful political machine that Washington has ever known, has twice beaten them at their own game. Mr. George Norris is a man worth knowing and watching. George W. Norris was worth watching, for his subsequent career in the Senate, to which he was elected shortly after his triumph over Cannon, earned him a reputation as one of the most courageous figures in American political life. The overthrow of Cannonism, although welcomed in Nebraska by all but a few party stalwarts, had nevertheless required tremendous courage and leadership on the part of a young congressman attacking his party's well-entrenched leaders and willing to sacrifice the comforts and alliances that party loyalty brings. We should not pretend that Norris was a faultless paragon of virtue. On the contrary, he was, on more than one occasion, emotional in his deliberations, vituperative in his denunciations, and prone to engage in bitter and exaggerated personal attack instead of concentrating his fire upon the merits of an issue. But nothing could sway him from what he thought was right, from his determination to help all the people, from his hope to save them from the twin tragedies of poverty and war. George Norris knew well the tragedy of poverty from his own boyhood. His father having died when George was only 4, he was obliged while still in his teens to hack out a livelihood for his mother and 10 sisters on the stump-covered farmlands of Ohio. He knew, too, the horrors of war, from the untimely death in the Civil War of the older brother he hardly remembered. In 1917, as the nation teetered on the edge of the European conflict, George Norris had not forgotten his mother's sorrow and her hatred of war. A country teacher, a small-town lawyer, a local prosecuting attorney and judge, those had been the years when George Norris had come to know the people of Nebraska, when he saw the growing pattern of farm foreclosures, lost homesteads, and farm workers drifting to the city and to unemployment. As the old 19th century became the new 20th, America was changing. Her industries and cities were growing. Her power in the world was increasing. And yet George Norris changed, and would change, very little. His chunky figure was still clothed in the drab black suits and little black shoestring ties he had worn most of his life and would wear until his death. His avoidance of the social circles of politics, in favor of a quiet evening of reading, set him apart from the career politicians of his country. Only his political outlook changed as he began the long career which would keep him in Washington for 40 years. For when George Norris had first entered the House of Representatives in 1903, fresh from the plains of Nebraska, he had been a staunch conservative Republican. His most enduring accomplishments were in the field of public power, and there are few parallels to his long fight to bring the benefits of low-cost electricity to the people of the Tennessee Valley, although they lived 1,000 miles from his home state of Nebraska. But there were 3 struggles in his life that are worthy of a special note for the courage displayed. The overthrow of Czar Cannon, already described, his support for Al Smith for president in 1928, and his filibuster against the Armed Ship Bill in 1917. When Woodrow Wilson sorrowfully determined upon a policy of armed neutrality in early 1917, appeared before a tense joint session of the Congress to request legislation authorizing him to arm American merchant ships, the American public gave its immediate approval. German submarine warfare was enforcing a tight blockade by which the Kaiser sought to starve the British Isles into submission. Already American vessels had been searched, seized, and sunk. Tales of atrocities to our seamen filled the press. As debate on the bill got underway, the newspapers learned of a new German scheme to align Mexico and Japan against the United States. In return for its use as an invasion base, Mexico was promised restoration of her American colonies, seized more than 70 years earlier by Sam Houston and his compatriots. All resistance to the Armed Ship Bill in the House of Representatives instantly collapsed. The bill was rushed through that body by an overwhelming vote of 403-13, a vote which seemed clearly representative of popular opinion in favor of the president's move. But in the Senate on March 2, 1917, the Armed Ship Bill met determined opposition from a small, bipartisan band of insurgents, led by Robert La Follette of Wisconsin and George Norris of Nebraska. In previous months, Norris had supported the president on major foreign policy issues. But George Norris hated war, and he feared that big business, which he believed was providing the stimuli for our progress along the road to war, was bent on driving the nation into a useless, bloody struggle. That the president, far from taking the people into his confidence, was trying to stampede public opinion into pressuring the Senate for war, and that the Armed Ship Bill was a device to protect American munition profits with American lives, a device which could push us directly into the conflict as a combatant without further deliberation by Congress or actual attack upon the United States by Germany. It is not now important whether Norris was right or wrong. What is now important is the courage he displayed in support of his convictions. In 1917, the freshman from Nebraska prepared for one of the hardest, most embittering struggles of his political career. Since those days were prior to Norris's own 20th, or lame duck, amendment, the 64th Congress would expire at noon of March 4th, when a new presidential term began. Thus, passage of the bill by that Congress could be prevented if the Senate could not vote before that hour. Preventing a vote during the next 2 days spelled only one word, filibuster. As parliamentary floor leader for his group, Norris arranged speakers to make certain that there was no possibility of a break in the debate which would enable the bill to come to a vote. As debate got underway, the Nebraska newspapers, in a thinly veiled warning, reported that the tremendous vote in the House represents the sentiments of the people. But George Norris's guide was his own conscience, and so the senator worked around the clock to bolster the sagging spirits of his little band, to prepare new speakers for continuous debate, and to check every opposition move to end the filibuster. Several senators, Norris later related, privately approached him to wish the filibuster success, while pleading party regularity and political expediency as their grounds for publicly supporting the president's position. When Norris told them that the important thing was to make certain there were plenty of speakers, regardless of the views expressed, two of the president's supporters, by private agreement with Norris, spoke at length in favor of the bill. Day and night the debate continued, and on the morning of March 4th, the Senate was a scene of weary disorder. Those final minutes, Norris later wrote, live in my memory. When the hour hand pointed to the arrival of noon, the chairman announced adjournment. The filibuster had won. I have felt from that day to this the filibuster was justified. We honestly believe that, by our actions in that struggle, we had averted American participation in the war. But theirs was a fleeting victory. For the president, in addition to immediately calling a special session of Congress in which the Senate adopted a closure rule to limit debate, also announced that a further examination of the statutes had revealed that the executive power already included the right to arm ships without congressional action. And the president also let loose a blast against a little group of willful men representing no opinion but their own that rendered the great government of the United States helpless and contemptible. George Norris called the president's scathing indictment a grave injustice to men who conscientiously tried to do their duty as they saw it. They had earned, in the words of the Louisville Courier-Journal, an eternity of execration. The New York Herald predicted, "They will be fortunate if their names do not go down into history bracketed with that of Benedict Arnold." In the decades to follow, Senator Norris would learn to withstand the merciless abuse inevitably heaped upon one of his independent and outspoken views. On the Senate floor itself, he would be called a Bolshevist, an enemy of advancement, a traitor, and much more. But now the harsh terms of vilification and the desertion of former friends hurt him deeply. It was believed in Washington that the conscience of the freshman from Nebraska had led him, in the words of one Washington correspondent, to his political death. The outraged Nebraska state legislature, with whooping enthusiasm, passed a resolution expressing the confidence of the state in President Wilson and his policies. George Norris was saddened by the near unanimity with which my own people condemned me and asserted that I was misrepresenting my state. Thus, unwilling to represent the people of Nebraska if they did not want me, he came to a dramatic decision. He would offer to resign from the Senate and submit it to a special recall election, to let my constituents decide whether I was representing them or misrepresenting them in Washington. In letters to the governor and the Republican state chairman, he urged a special election, agreeing to abide by the result and to waive whatever constitutional rights protected him from recall. The senator, announcing an open meeting in Lincoln to explain his position, was largely ignored by the press as he journeyed homeward. Unable to get a single friend or supporter to act as chairman, Norris was nevertheless determined to go through with the meeting. More than 3,000 people, the concerned, the skeptical, and the curious, had filled the auditorium, with many standing in the aisles and outside in the street. Calm but trembling, he walked out on the stage before them and began with the simple phrase, "I have come home to tell you the truth." Immediately there was a burst of applause from all parts of the audience, and the tremendous crowd cheered mightily as Norris lashed out at his critics. He insisted that their newspapers were not giving them the facts, and that, despite warnings that he stay away until his role in the filibuster was forgotten, he wanted it to be remembered. The crowd, after more than an hour, roared its approval. The newspapers were not so easily convinced or so willing to forgive. But Senator Norris, who was asked to appear before many groups to explain what he felt to be the true issues, met acclaim throughout the state, and the governor having announced that he would not ask the legislature to authorize a special recall election, the senator returned to Washington, better able to withstand the abuse which had not yet fully ceased. During the next 11 years, George Norris's fame and political fortunes multiplied. In 1928, despite his continued differences with the Republican Party and its administrations, the Nebraska senator was one of the party's most prominent members, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and a potential presidential nominee. With an oath, he rejected the suggestion that he accept a position as Herbert Hoover's running mate, and he attacked the Republican convention's platform and the methods by which it had selected its nominee. Unwilling to commit himself to the Democratic Party he had always opposed, and whose platform he believed to be equally weak, Norris toured the country campaigning for fellow progressives regardless of party. But as the campaign utterances of Democratic nominee Al Smith of New York began to fall into line with Norris's own views, he was confronted with the most difficult political problem of his career. George Norris was a Republican, a Midwesterner, a Protestant, and a dry. And Herbert Hoover was all of those things. But Al Smith, a Tammany Hall Democrat from the streets of New York, and a Catholic who favored the repeal of Prohibition, was none of them. Surely Smith could have little support in Nebraska, which was also Republican, Midwestern, Protestant, and dry by nature. Could Norris possibly desert his party, his state, and his constituents under such circumstances? He could. He had always maintained that he would like to abolish party responsibility and in its stead establish personal responsibility. Any man, even though he be the strictest kind of Republican, who does not believe the things I stand for are right, should follow his convictions and vote against me. And thus, in 1928, Norris finally declared that progressives had no place to land except in the Smith camp. These were courageous sentiments, but they were lost on an indignant constituency. Unmoved by either appeals or attacks, he delivered a powerful plea for Smith at Omaha. He closed his address by meeting the religious issue openly. "It is our duty as patriots to cast out this un-American doctrine and rebuke those who have raised the torch of intolerance. All believers of any faith can unite and go forward in our political work to bring about the maximum amount of happiness for our people." But in 1928, the people of Nebraska were not willing to listen to the theme of tolerance or a discussion of the issues. Telegrams poured in attacking Norris for his support of a Catholic and a wet. The storm which followed that Omaha pronouncement for Smith, Norris later recalled, was more violent than any I had ever encountered. It was well that I had had some training in the matter of abuse. His speech had endangered the chances for re-election of his own liberal Republican colleague, and his fellow insurgent Republicans in the Senate expressed their disapproval of his course. When the senator returned to his hometown, he found his friends and other leading citizens turning away, as though they would be glad to cut my heart out and hang it on a fence as a warning to others. The landslide for Hoover, who carried practically every county and community in Nebraska, as well as the country as a whole, embittered Norris, who declared that Hoover had won on the false questions of religion and prohibition, when the real problems were power and farm relief. George Norris's filibuster against the armed ship bill had failed, both in its immediate goal of preventing the president's action and in its attempt to keep the nation out of the war into which it was plunged a few months later. His campaign for Al Smith also failed, and failed dismally. And yet, as the senator confided to a friend in later years, "It happens very often that one tries to do something and fails. He feels discouraged, and yet he may discover, years afterwards, that the very effort he made was the reason why somebody else took it up and succeeded. I really believe that whatever use I have been to progressive civilization has been accomplished in the things I failed to do than in the things I actually did do." Robert A. Taft. Senator Robert A. Taft of Ohio was never President of the United States. Therein lies his personal tragedy, and therein lies his national greatness. For the presidency was a goal that Bob Taft pursued throughout his career in the Senate, an ambition that this son of a former president always dreamed of realizing. As the leading exponent of the Republican philosophy for more than a decade, Mr. Republican was bitterly disappointed by his failure on three different occasions even to receive the nomination. But Robert A. Taft was also a man who stuck fast to the basic principles in which he believed. And when those fundamental principles were at issue, not even the lure of the White House or the possibilities of injuring his candidacy could deter him from speaking out. He was an unusual leader, for he lacked the fine arts of oratory and phrase-making. He lacked blind devotion to the party line, unless he dictated it. And he lacked the politician's natural instinct to avoid controversial positions and issues. But he was more than a political leader. More than Mr. Republican. He was also a Taft, and thus Mr. Integrity. The senator's grandfather, Alfonso Taft, had moved west to practice law in 1830, writing his father that the notorious selfishness and dishonesty of the great mass of men you find in New York is to my mind a serious obstacle to settling there. And the senator's father was William Howard Taft, who knew well the meaning of political courage and political abuse when he stood by his Secretary of Interior, Ballinger, against the overwhelming opposition of Pinchot, Roosevelt, and the progressive elements of his own party. So Bob Taft, as his biographer has described it, was born to integrity. He was known in the Senate as a man who never broke an agreement, who never compromised his deeply felt Republican principles, who never practiced political deception. Perhaps we are as yet too close in time to the controversial elements in the career of Senator Taft to be able to measure his life with historical perspective. But sufficient time has passed since 1946 to enable something of a detached view of Senator Taft's act of courage in that year. Unlike the acts of Daniel Webster or Edmund Ross, it did not change history. Unlike those of John Quincy Adams or Thomas Benton, it did not bring about his retirement from the Senate. Unlike most of those deeds of courage previously described, it did not even take place on the Senate floor. But, as a piece of sheer candor in a time when candor was out of favor, as a bold plea for justice in a time of intolerance and hostility, it is worth remembering here. In October of 1946, Senator Robert A. Taft of Ohio was the chief spokesman for the Republicans in Washington, the champion of his party in the national political arena, and the likely Republican nominee for the presidency in 1948. It was a time when even a senator with such an established reputation for speaking his mind would have guarded his tongue, and particularly a senator with so much at stake as Bob Taft. The party which had been his whole life, the Republicans of the Congress for whom he spoke, now once again were nearing the brink of success in the fall elections. Capturing for his party control of both houses of Congress would enhance Bob Taft's prestige, reinforce his right to the Republican presidential nomination, and pave the way for his triumphant return to the White House, from which his father had been somewhat ungloriously ousted in 1912. Or so it seemed to most political observers at the time, who assumed the Republican leader would say nothing to upset the apple cart. With Congress out of session, with the tide running strongly against the incumbent Democrats, there appeared to be no necessity for the senator to make more than the usual campaign utterances on the usual issues. But Senator Taft was disturbed, and when he was disturbed, it was his habit to speak out. He was disturbed by the war crimes trials of Axis leaders, then concluding in Germany and about to commence in Japan. The Nuremberg trials, in which 11 notorious Nazis had been found guilty under an impressively documented indictment for waging an aggressive war, had been popular throughout the world, and particularly in the United States. Equally popular was the sentence already announced by the High Tribunal. Death. But what kind of trial was this? No matter how many books are written or briefs filed, Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas has written, no matter how finely the lawyers analyzed it, the crime for which the Nazis were tried had never been formalized as a crime with the definiteness required by our legal standards, nor outlawed with a death penalty by the international community. By our standards, that crime arose under an ex post facto law. Göring et al. Deserved severe punishment, but their guilt did not justify us in substituting power for principle. These conclusions are shared, I believe, by a substantial number of American citizens today, and they were shared, at least privately, by a goodly number in 1946. But no politician of consequence would speak out, certainly not after the verdict had already been announced and the preparations for the executions were already underway. None, that is, but Senator Taft. The Constitution of the United States was the gospel which guided the policy decisions of the senator from Ohio. It was his source, his weapon, and his salvation. And when the Constitution commanded no ex post facto laws, Bob Taft accepted this precept as permanently wise and universally applicable. The Constitution was not a collection of loosely given political promises subject to broad interpretation. It was not a list of pleasing platitudes to be set lightly aside when expediency required it. It was the foundation of the American system of law and justice, and he was repelled by the picture of his country discarding those constitutional precepts in order to punish a vanquished enemy. Still, why should he say anything? The Nuremberg trials were at no time before the Congress for consideration. They were not in any sense an issue in the campaign. There was no Republican or Democratic position on a matter enthusiastically applauded by the entire nation. And no speech by any United States senator, however powerful, could prevent the death sentence from being carried out. To speak out unnecessarily would be politically costly and clearly futile. But Bob Taft spoke out. On October 6, 1946, Senator Taft appeared before a conference on our Anglo-American heritage, sponsored by Kenyon College in Ohio. The war crimes trial was not an issue upon which conference speakers were expected to comment. But titling his address, Equal Justice Under Law, Taft cast aside his general reluctance to embark upon startlingly novel and dramatic approaches. The trial of the vanquished by the victors, he told an attentive if somewhat astonished audience, cannot be impartial no matter how it is hedged about with the forms of justice. I question whether the hanging of those who, however despicable, were the leaders of the German people, will ever discourage the making of an aggressive war. For no one makes aggressive war unless he expects to win. About this whole judgment there is the spirit of vengeance, and vengeance is seldom justice. The hanging of the 11 men convicted will be a blot on the American record which we shall long regret. In 10 days the Nazi leaders were to be hanged. But Bob Taft deplored that sentence and suggested that involuntary exile, similar to that imposed upon Napoleon, might be wiser. But even more deplorable, he said, were the trials themselves, which violate the fundamental principle of American law that a man cannot be tried under an ex post facto statute. Nuremberg, the Ohio senator insisted, was a blot on American constitutional history and a serious departure from our Anglo-Saxon heritage of fair and equal treatment, a heritage which had rightly made this country respected throughout the world. We can't even teach our own people the sound principles of liberty and justice, he concluded. We cannot teach them government in Germany by suppressing liberty and justice. As I see it, the English-speaking peoples have one great responsibility. That is to restore to the minds of men a devotion to equal justice under law. The speech exploded in the midst of a heated election campaign, and throughout the nation Republican candidates scurried for shelter while Democrats seized the opportunity to advance. Many, many people were outraged at Taft's remarks. Those who had fought, or whose men had fought and possibly died, to beat back the German aggressors were contemptuous of these fine phrases by a politician who had never seen battle. Those whose kinsmen or former countrymen had been among the Jews, Poles, Czechs, and other nationality groups terrorized by Hitler and his cohorts were shocked. The memories of the gas chambers at Buchenwald and other Nazi concentration camps, the stories of hideous atrocities which had been refreshed with new illustrations at Nuremberg, and the anguish and suffering which each new military casualty list had brought to thousands of American homes, these were among the immeasurable influences which caused many to react with pain and indignation when a United States senator deplored the trials and sentences of these merely despicable men. even in the nation's capital, where Taft was greatly admired and his blunt candor was more or less expected, the reaction was no different. GOP leaders generally declined official comment, but privately expressed their fears over the consequences for their congressional candidates. The Democrats, however, were jubilant, although concealing their glee behind a facade of shocked indignation. Even in Taft's home bailiwick of Ohio, where his strict constitutionalism had won